November 2011 meeting of Monterey Advisory Council to order. We have a busy agenda tonight with two presentations on two topics that we decided we want to weigh in on because they're coming up for consideration. So let's begin with public comment. Is anyone signed?
Linda, did you want to speak? If you want to speak, then you can go up to the microphone. Or I can just take this.
As you know, Linda, you have 2 minutes.
When the light will turn.
Yes.
I'm Maria, I live up in Northeast. We have a situation where there was an accident on Monroe Street going to the station. And I was coming back from Fort Todd on the 80 bus. It was running about 30 minutes late. This was during the end of rush hour. And the bus could not turn into the metro station, which meant it sat there on the street for how long? I don't know, because the street was blocked with emergency equipment. Now, there is another exit. I think it's for the cars and we just missed. You know, but the bus driver, I guess, is not authorized to go there. There is a back way into Brooklyn Station. Some of the buses use it. And I'm just wondering if this could be a consideration for the metro stations and other, you know, places, trains and places where buses go in and out, to have another way for the buses to get in and out of the station so they won't get caught up when there's an accident.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, we go on to approving the agenda and I'd like to make one amendment to it. So I'm going to move that we amend the agenda by adding an item 6A, which is the proposal and hopefully passage of a three-sentence letter on station naming that's in your packets and that you received by email today. So is there a second for that? We're going to amend the agenda by adding a, passing a letter on station naming. And we'll do that at 6A after the presentations. I don't think it will take long. It's a very short letter and it's on something we've already discussed many times. So. Second, is there any discussion? I'll assume, unless there's objection, that amendment is, the agenda is satisfactory. Thank you. Approval of past meeting minutes. You have two in your packet for September and October. So first we'll take September. Are there any amendments to the September minutes? Hearing none, I'll assume that they are passed. The October minutes? Any amendments to them? Seeing none, I'll assume that they are passed as well. We now go on to the first of our two presentations tonight. Our first presenter on the metro rail, metro bus fare structure model is someone who was here just last month. A planner from the Department of Long Range Planning, Michael Ackbar. So thank you for coming back.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be back again. I always enjoy talking about this stuff with any audience out there. So here I am. Feel free to ask me to give my name for future meetings if you want. So as the title indicates, we are working on a model right now that will help us estimate the impact of changes to our fare structure as well as changes to our actual fares themselves. And so we are going to give you a presentation right now which describes what we're doing. We're going to first review this fare structure and then describe that model that we're developing and what it does, and then talk about some possible fare structures that we will be looking at for the sake of looking at fare structures. adopting, and some that we may want to evaluate to show people why it is that we don't want to adopt the conservative restrictions. So, why are we doing this now? That's a really good question. The timing of this effort supports a variety of current initiatives. First off, you know, we received some customer feedback from focus groups we had about a year ago that describes in some capacity of our infrequent users of figuring out how much their fare was supposed to be. You know, we have, I'll describe a little bit more, but our fare structure is relatively complicated, and when we hear some feedback, they want it to be a little bit easier. Secondly, we do have a current RFP out for the new electronic payments program. And what that is the, adding the ability for either a cell phone or a credit card taps directly to the fare base, allowing you to have access to the system, and would bill you either directly to your credit card or bill you to your cell phone. Basically, allow anyone without a smart card, but with a smart phone or a smart credit card, to tap their card on the fare gate and just access the system. They wouldn't have to purchase any fare media at the station. So we're working on that, and it turns out that our really complicated fare structure is actually really expensive to implement using for the new kind of payments program. There's a lot of different time periods and numbers, a lot of math, and the more complicated it is, the more expensive it would be to implement as it is under any PP. So that's a factor that we're keeping in mind. And then also, it always helps to help assess how well our current fare structure is balanced with the board's fare policy principles. Those were adopted about a year ago, almost about a year ago now. And we are, you know, our last assessment of our fare increase, we looked at our fare policy principles and how well they held up with our fare structure. We're going to show you a copy in the appendix of these PowerPoints. You can see those fare policy principles and our rating for how well our current fare structure mirrors those principles. And then finally, you know, we are also working on that FY15 budget. And 2 years ago, the chair at the time said that we were going to move into a cycle where we wouldn't have budget, or we wouldn't have fare increases more frequently than once every 2 years. Well, it's been 2 years since our last fare increase, so, you know, given the current situation, we may end up having fare increases this time around. So it would be useful to have a tool that can tell us better what the impact of that fare increase might be. So briefly, let's go ahead and review what our current fare structure is. If you want to look at the screen to get a little bit of a chuckle as it's an enemy inside, our fare structure basically starts off with our base fare of up to 3 miles is $1.95. And then from there, if you for the next 3 miles, it's almost 30 cents per mile. And then for the next anything more than 6 miles, then 0.265. Cents per mile, and then from there we then cap it at $5. So, you know, we've got this is kind of hard and complicated, but then you'll notice that we've got 86 by 86 is the number of fare options currently on this. Well, if you want to go to the next one, we'll see, well, that's only for a peak period. What about our off-peak or discounted fares? Well, for that, 7 miles is $1.60, followed by the next 3 miles being but flat, not just per mile, which is flat. And then the third one being an additional 60 cents if you go more than 10 miles. So, well, now we've got, you know, we've got two different tiers, if you want to, but we also have a third tier, which is peak of the peak, which is additional 20 cents on top of our peak fares, which results down in 3 different times a day. So we've got 86 by 86 by 3. And then, well, we also have this paper fare charge or paper surcharge for paper cards, and that applies both peak and off peak, which is another two dimensions, another dimension of two options there. And then we overlay on top of that, we've got senior and disabled fares, which means you've got a half price discount for all of your fares. And if you do the math, you end up with over 44,000 combinations for your fare money. Now, what your actual fare is, there's not enough numbers between zero and our max fare to make it up 44,000, but that's the math that goes into it. There's a lot of different combinations and permutations, and you know, it isn't simple. You know, we need some help to help our customers understand what their fares are. However, if you flip the next slide, you'll notice here that our board historically, you know, since the system was open, it's always preferred social equity to simplicity, and the more granular your fare is, the more equitable it is. If someone is traveling 1 mile, why should they pay the same amount or, why should someone who's traveling 5 miles pay the same amount as someone who's traveling 1 mile? Why someone who's traveling 12 miles have the same fare as someone who's traveling 1 mile? So the general idea is that you get what you pay for, you pay for what you get. The user pays principle. And our board has always historically favored that equity of this user pays principle over simplicity. And that's kind of how we got to where we are today. And the third tier, the people who ride during the peak, put a higher cost on the system, and more transfer hours during that time, so they should be able to a little bit more offset the additional cost. So if you want to put the next slide here, so just to recap the fare cost principles, you're going to have seven of them, and you can cover a wide variety of the aspects of our fares. And just real briefly, if you want to summarize them, they are, customer satisfaction, developing the mechanism for allowing fares to ease in deferment, optimizing the use of existing capacity, trying to get as many people on trains as we can and on buses, establish equitable fares and ensure compliance with the federal regulations. We also want to facilitate movement between modes and between operators, so between bus and rail, between one bus operator and another one. We want to encourage people to move towards smarter cars because those are more cost effective for us. And we want to also generate adequate revenue while maximizing our ridership. We want to, our goal isn't to build a club where we can make a lot of money. Our goal is to provide as many trips as we can while recouping as much of our costs as possible. So our priority is really there on ridership more than revenue. So we want to talk a little bit about this fare model. What are we talking about and how what are the pieces that are going into it? The slide gets a little complicated, but what we're really trying to show here is that this fare model is basically made up of a variety of different types of inputs from the Metro board, from you guys, the Metro riders, and from other stakeholders internal to the Metro sort of process. So the Metro board establishes fare policy principles, and those have basically not only gone into helping develop what the fare concepts would be, which is the second box there on the bottom row, what the different concepts would be. So a flat fare is a concept. And the idea of simplicity, customer satisfaction, might help indicate, hey, maybe a flat fare would be something we could look at. But then also the fare policy principles also go to feed into our evaluation criteria. So how, when we evaluate a given concept or a scenario, the model, we look at how well it meets the board's policy principles. Now, as again, the riding public has also had the opportunity to provide input to this process. We conducted a survey where we, I believe we got 2,500 responses from a survey that was conducted over the course of a week. It's done in, I think it was in August that we performed the survey, and we asked, riders questions such as, would you be interested in a unlimited use monthly pass if it worked a certain way? Would you be interested in paying a little bit extra if you had a faster bus ride? Would you be interested in using your cell phone to pay for your fare on the bus or on the train? And we took all of that information. That's just a brief sample of the sorts of questions we asked. I don't know if anyone in this room gets a sample for the survey? No? Actually, this is done at the stations where people are coming out during the morning peak. We're trying to get people on surveys. And if anyone's like me, I'd walk right by that person with my headphones on, wait for work. I don't know if I can take that survey. But there were over 2,000 people who did respond to the survey. And so we take those rider preferences and we turn those into mathematical equations that then help us understand how people's behavior might change as the fare structure or the fare values might change. And then finally, we asked some of our internal employees, our executive leadership team, as well as members of the jurisdictional coordinating committee, and we asked them how they feel about the different fare policy principles, and which one of those are maybe more important than others, and then to help us weight the different criteria so that we can then come up with some fare structures or some fare concepts that would better reflect the authorities' interests and make sure that we are moving forward with something that's best for everyone. So that's the general structure of the model. Again, it's focused on a lot of inputs from a lot of different groups, including the board, riders, and stakeholders. So let's just briefly talk about some of the different concepts that we're evaluating. And again, as I said earlier, we're not necessarily evaluating these concepts because we want to use them. We're evaluating these concepts because we don't know how our riders might react to them. And it'd be nice to know, like, we don't have a higher share right now on six-stop bus operations, but what would happen if we did? And we may find out that it would be a really bad idea. So okay, we're not doing that. Good on us. We're not doing this topic. So well, let's just talk about some of the different concepts and then talk about some of the softer side. What are the implications of doing these sorts of things? So for example, first one is higher fare for mini bus. Everyone in this room probably knows that we have a certain set of bus routes. Generally they end at 9, such as the X9 and the X9 and the 79 and the 39 and the 37. And also the Rex routes, and those are kind of express skip-stop operations that are overlaid on top of existing local routes. And those buses do a pretty good job moving people pretty quickly. They stop about once or twice per mile instead of a regular 5 to 10 stops per mile. And you can get yourself from Silverstone to downtown DC a lot quicker on the 79 or the S9 than you can on the local ones because those stop just about every block. So the idea here would be that you've got a bus that may provide more benefit to someone because it's faster. So well, maybe someone riding that bus might be interested in paying a little bit more to help recoup the cost of operating that service. So again, in our survey, riders said they were willing to pay a little bit more for a faster trip on bus. And you know, some of these bus routes are really popular. That money pulls up and it's past the hills. You can't get on it. A lot of people who would pay more for that bus maybe won't have the option to take it because it's slower when they get there, when it arrives. So a larger fare might help reduce crowding on those services and maybe provide opportunities for people who currently don't have them. But the problem is that this increases our fare capacity instead of reducing it. Right? You know, we're talking about possibility of reducing price in our fare structure, and here's something that goes the other thing. But maybe, again, equity versus simplicity. Our board is always erring on the side of equity. Before I go to the next idea, this is something kind of interesting idea. Like, let's say you ride the Metro Rail and you pay a fare of $3, and then you jump on a bus. Why should you have to pay again? You already paid $3. Why should you have to pay another dollar with the transfer? The idea would be, let's say we just pretended we had a very integrated rail and bus system, and that fare you pay on one mode automatically applies to the next one. So on the other way around, you take a bus to Metro, you pay $1.59 smart trip to your bus, you tap it on the train, and then when you exit, it charges you the difference between the $1.50 you already paid and the rail fare that you were paying that someone else would have already paid. The idea is, you know, it improves customer convenience. You don't have to pay two fares. You can kind of visualize that as being one trip instead of two separate trips with a slight discount between them. And it will help promote intermodal travel, which we saw was one of the fare policy principles. But, you know, honestly, like, we're giving a lot of people some stuff for free that they're currently paying for. We have to make up for that revenue somehow. So there are, you know, concerns with that concept as well. We would like to know what would be the change in revenue if we were to implement that. And the fare model would tell us there's a decrease in revenue and maybe what the increase in ridership would be if we were to implement such a system. Integrated monthly pass, this idea kind of bubbled up from Greater Washington. Michael Perkins has got a campaign where he wants to have us offer a pass where you can ride, you pick what your fare level is, you buy 40 times that sort of base trip, and then you can ride that trip or that trip's cost or cheaper unlimited for a month. That is a really interesting concept. It would definitely improve customer convenience and encourage people to travel off-peak, which is another one of our fare policy principles. And what we found that from the survey, there's a high level of interest for a pass like this. However, we don't know necessarily how that would impact the bottom line. Would we lose revenue or would we gain it? For every person who's currently taking 60 trips a month, how many people are they taking 35 who would want to buy this pass? So how would that math work out? The fare model will tell us that. Again, the other thing is it will help flatten out and guarantee our revenue. If we have a snowstorm, people who bought a pass, not anticipating that snowstorm, they would, you know, they are okay with the pass, so we would have a more consistent base of revenue in the case of accidents. If the federal government shut down, snowstorms, there would be nice for us. The next one would be eliminating the peak-to-peak rail surcharge. I don't know how you guys would feel about this. I mean, sadly, I don't pay my fares. I don't had passed. So the thing is, all Metro employees were immune to all this, we just happened to have one of them. So it was good to hear from our ridership how they feel about these sorts of things. You know, one idea we could take away is B2B, that definitely increased simplicity. B2B is, you know, people are feeling like we're gouging them, they don't know, we don't have a choice, we can't change our time, we have to be working on time, we just have to pay it. And so we're moving that would make things simpler for a lot of different people, but we're also decrease our revenue, which is we have to make it up somehow. I mean, somebody on the blog somewhere said, you know, remove the peak of the peak, what we're going to end up doing is just taking the regular fares and raising them to the peak of the peak price, so everyone will get peak of the peak instead of just people during that 90-minute period. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's revenue that we're currently getting, and if we were to remove it, we would lose that revenue. So how are we going to look up for that some other way? And again, the people who are riding in that B2B group are putting the highest cost on the system. The most trains run in that period. Stations are crowded. So marginal cost of an additional ride over there is a lot higher. So from a equity perspective, it makes sense for us to charge a little bit more during that period. So again, we'll find out how the revenue will be impacted in the ridership if we were to change or remove the PPP. Another one we're looking at is a zone-based rail fare, and this is another idea that's bubbled out of here in Washington. Matt Johnson developed this map and worked with Michael Perkins on a proposal to look at a zone-based fare. You guys have specific zones, just peak versus off-peak. We're not going to touch the bus for this concept. And you know, the idea is that this may be simpler for riders, but it might not be. I know that I've looked at the zone map before and scratched my head and went to their website. And it's from zone 8 to zone 9, from zone 7 to zone 8 or 9. So, whoa, I don't know. So maybe it's easier, maybe it's not. It would probably reduce the actual number of fares that you have to pay, so figuring out what that might be may or may not actually be easier. Zone-based fares do raise equity concerns where you've got people who are going to take a trip and only crosses one of the crosses of a zone boundary and only really goes one stop. Why would that person have to pay more than someone else who maybe went three or four stops, but didn't cross the zone boundary? Especially if you know, you've got one really, you know, a long trip along only one zone. So again, we want to talk about equity. People who are taking longer trips, generally, they'll pay more for that one, but some people want to get kind of stuck because they have to cross the zone boundary. And this will also probably reduce the costs for this, you know, the payments program we're talking about. So we're looking at that one as well. And then the other idea would be, what if you're going to do a flat fare? What would that do? And, you know, New York City's got a flat fare, and how would that treat us? Well, if we looked at the rail system only and we figured out that basically the flat fare of $2.70 if we were to break even when it comes to revenue. The revenue neutral flat fare would be about $2.70 per fare. And we wouldn't charge any time of day differential, we would maintain paper surcharge, and we maintain our weekly discounts, resulting in basically four different fares instead of 44,000. Well, how would that look? Well, you know, it's the simplest, but we asked our riders within our survey, would you be willing to pay a little bit more to have a flat fare? It would be simpler, but you know, we're going to have winners and we're going to have losers. There's a chance you might be one of those losers. Would you be willing to pay that extra amount to have that easy convenience? And overwhelmingly, our riders said that they weren't interested in paying more for simplicity. So that's something for us to be aware of. I mean, we definitely have jurisdictional equity concerns. We've got all of our jurisdictions are now paying a certain amount of subsidy, and this would throw all of that into the air. We have a hard time figuring out how to reestablish jurisdictional equity. And it would also cause issues for riders. If we've got people who are taking affordable trips before, it wouldn't be affordable anymore. How would we help compensate them? What would happen if we sort of decided that persons with low income or persons with disabilities were more adversely impacted? It would definitely be a challenge there. But again, it would have low development costs for people on payments. $270. That's all we need. So we're using this fare model because we want to evaluate concepts, not because we want to do them, because we're interested in seeing how our ridership and where we need to change. And partially so that we can say, hey, this is a good idea, let's think about this, and hey, this is a bad idea. Good thing we're not doing that one. So, you know, there's a variety of other concepts that we're looking at. I don't want you to go over them very much, but just want you to know kind of what the next steps are. We have a current draft of the model that does do output of a lot of these different scenarios so far. There are a couple of them we can evaluate, but most of them we can. But we are working on Title VI and subsidy allocation modules so that we can actually know a first cut version of who would be impacted negatively, or rather the impact would be more towards any persons with disabilities or low income, and also how that would impact the funding of the subsidy. We're also going to compare structures scenarios and test them and see how they shake out. And then we're currently shooting to have a recommendation to board in January 2012 of way of how we as staff think we may want the fair structure to move forward. So that's all I really have. I'll be more glad to answer any questions you have about their model, their structures, how all these things should shake out.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Eichler. I'm going to ask, because we do have a busy agenda, that you really try to keep your comments brief and one comment or question per person, and then if we have time, we'll go around again. But one comment or question per person. Chris?
I have a question about peak and peak. It seems to me that like boarding is right around the threshold of the beginning and the end of the peak of the peak. Might be a telling signature of whether it's having much impact on rider decisions. Riders are conscious of the 7:30 start or peak in the morning.
Right. Well, we've done an assessment of the ridership impact of the peak. We actually went to the board of the community in April, and part of that was that we determined that about 3% of the peak of the trips during that 9-minute period during each week, about 3% of those trips moved away from the peak. So there was a shift, and you know, when you're that congested, 3% might actually, you might notice it. You know, if you just take one car off the road, that's one place where someone else can move forward to. So we may think that there is some shift in people from to the regular period.
Thank you, sir.
Ernest, thank you. Thanks, sir. I think you're aware that we've been working with you now for a while with the AAC, and I have a paper or a report in this packet tonight that talks about some of the principles you've gone over and that we're going to be talking to and moving forward with through my committee and the board. Brian Farr, who's worked with us, basically indicated that between bus and rail, there's a combination of 327,000 combinations of bus and rail that are out there, and we shared that with Carol Kissel last month when she spoke to my committee. Number one, I appreciate this report. I appreciate you working with my committee and the RAC on this, because this is very critical. It's extremely critical for the Metro Access group and for that group, because the fares, if you think these fares are complicated, come to some of my committee meetings where the fares for the same trips bounce between $4 and $6 or $4 and $7 for a group that really can't afford the fares bouncing all over the place. We will be pleased to be working with you. I think that this is very important. Frank, I think for really both groups to come to a consensus on what we want to and how we want to move forward, because what happens with the fixed system is going to affect the Metro Access system. We are very, you know, we want to work with you. We think it's great that you come to us with this information. Frank, I think it's something that the AAC and RAC need to coordinate on, because whatever we figure out for the fixed route system is going to affect Metro Access, and that's 28,000 people. So good work. We've got a lot more to do. I appreciate the principles that you guys have put forward. There's a lot there for this group, I think, to digest. And I think it's worth putting the effort into. Thank you.
And I agree, and we do have some time to formulate a decision on this so we can coordinate. Yes?
It's
interesting reading these other concepts being evaluated. Stored value bonus used to be something the Metro did, and 7 day, 1 day passes are not new, that's something that Metro used to do, as well as not charge for buses after being on rail. And the other thing, I would hope when this is going to be rolled out, they're also rolling out a plan of improving service and service structure, because as service has been undoubtedly been declining, that fares go up again, it's, there's going to be decreased ridership of people that are just not going to, it's not moving. Sure. Term?
One of the comments I hear from friends, particularly people who don't use the system constantly, but from time to time go different places, is they're very confused about the fares and why did it charge me this. So I'm a strong advocate of simplifying the fare, not necessarily maybe down to three or something like that, but have you considered combining some of the simpler systems like the zones, and maybe you have three zones or three flat fares, something like that, so that you get it down to six different fares or eight different fares, maybe a difference or a rush hour. But again, I think most people find it really confusing as to why they're paying what they're paying. Have you considered kind of a combination of those things to get it down to maybe 10 different fares?
Well, I mean, the zone structure that we look at here really only has five different fares. There's $2 for the first zone.
But I am concerned about the equity issue also. That's why I'm suggesting maybe that you could have different fares for different zones, but have not so many zones, but have flat fares and also have rush hour fares. Just some combination of those to get it down to maybe 10 or 12 basic fares so people understand what they're paying.
Yeah, we thought about a variety of things. Another idea would be to have each jurisdiction be its own zone. And so if you're traveling within Montgomery County can subsidize you however you want. If you cross the border, then all of a sudden, rather than pay a different fare, how would that work? What if you're in French Heights? You know, it's already barely in Virginia.
It sounds very complicated.
Well, exactly. you're understanding that what I've understood in the last 6 months, which is no matter how you slice it, it's going to be complicated. We're working
really
hard on
this. Joseph. I really like the presentation. Thank you very much for the presentation. As someone who rides the train in the morning, the flat fare would be actually a decrease in my, I pay like $3.15 a day. So that would be probably a decrease, but if you get on at 9 o'clock, you would see that increase. I can see where the concern. And I just wanted to say, the only thing that caught my attention, that kept catching my attention, is the difference of how you are describing equity, and for some people that means something differently. And so I think the way that I'm hearing what you're describing, you describe equity is more about fairness and not equity, and so whether or not it's fair that if you go into the zone by one stop, if you should pay the same thing as a person going into the zone by three stops. Because equity more is whether or not a person can afford to pay it, or whether or not that person, you know, that's what social equity normally means. And so when you describe social equity that way, it confuses some people because there's a difference between social equity and fairness.
Thank you for the presentation. I have a question about the flat rail fares, the one they said there are only four different fares. So what are the four options?
The four options would be full fare with a smartphone card, full fare with a paper card, senior or disabled with a smartphone card, senior or disabled with a paper card.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is more on the zones. As we have right now, there are a lot of bus routes that cross through several, would be crossing through several zones. And seems to me that if I'm just going to be riding on one zone, getting in and out and off the bus within one or maybe two zones, I mean, you cannot charge the same fare from the prison. It goes all the way to the end of the process four zone. So how would that be working?
Well, we actually, the idea of a zone-based for bus fares has been topped up, but it hasn't really been looked at. The issue with that is that, I mean, what do you do? You get to a zone boundary, you get to Western Avenue and then stop the bus, and then you have everyone get up and tap their fare card again? I mean, there are systems that when they were cash-based, the driver would get up and he'd walk down the aisle and get another quarter from everyone. We're kind of beyond that point. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that if you're riding a bus, you're not getting anywhere anywhere fast, really. I mean, unless you're an express bus and you should break down the freeway or the HMV lane. If you're riding all the way to the end, chances are you're doing that because you don't have other options. And so charging someone extra for the slow trip almost seems sometimes counterintuitive. So I don't think we're looking very seriously at zone-based bus fares right now. We can do it on rail, but you tap in and tap out. So if the rail system knows where you got on and where you got off, you can calculate the OD pair for you and then charge your fare. So do you like the idea of zone-based fares on buses?
No, that's why I was confused when I saw it. It was the people that I trusted.
Right. And then again, on slide 28, it says no changes to us. Right. This is just for rail.
One quick question. Once the fare model evaluation process is complete, what are the fare structure concepts that you mentioned in the presentation? Are those, I mean, it's kind of a follow up to what Ron was asking. Are those really the only concepts being considered, or are there other hybrids of them?
The general idea is that we want to pick an idea for how each one of these separate concepts impacts the fare structure and the ridership and revenue and how well they meet the four principles. And then we're going to combine them into scenarios. And maybe we can have a scenario that's focused on ridership. We want to get the highest ridership we can with this scenario. And then we'll try another scenario that's focused completely on, for example, convenience. And that would maybe be one that would have maybe not even a flat fare on rail, but a flat fare completely, right? Or cross hand rail, one fare. Okay, once on bus, four rail, so how would that work, right? And find out those sorts of things. So find out new combinations of them. I mean, if you have any ideas for other sorts of concepts that are currently under evaluation, we'd be glad to see what they are and incorporate those into maybe a scenario where it makes sense.
Just one other question. You mentioned that there was a survey that was done in August. Is that available online, or could that be made available to us to look over the questions that were asked at the riders?
Yeah, I think we can make the survey questions available.
Okay. And possibly the results of, or maybe a high level?
Yeah, I think we probably have a one-page summary that we can also send out to your group. We'll have to check with our marketing department and make sure that there is sensitive information in the results.
Yeah, I will. It's on the list.
Hi, I thought this was a very informative presentation. Thank you for that. I just have one comment and a question. I guess my first comment is I think it would be useful for me and for this body if we could have maybe a breakout of the results that would explain, I'm sorry, a grouping of the results from those that just take the bus, those that take bus to rail, and those that just take the rail to see if there are any similarities. And it might be that one has already done that, but just so that we can see what people had to say in those three categories. The other, I guess, comment that I had is there's a slide in here where you talk about higher fares for the limited stop routes. And I wanted to know if any consideration was giving to raising the fares on those express routes, like the P17 that I think is currently $3, and not making sure it's just these limited stop routes, it's the express routes that are coming from the suburbs as well. And one last comment, I think that, you know, raising the fares, if that happens, that's great, but I hope that WMATA seriously takes into consideration that they are certain they can make sure the level of service they provide now stays constant and hopefully is better with whatever fare changes they make.
I want to say a thank you for this presentation, and I think that fair model contract is great. But the two things we need to focus on is revenue and the ridership. For revenue, will there be increased revenue or decreased revenue? Also, for the number of ridership. That way, I think the only way we can get there and assessment of how valid or worthwhile you may need for public health.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's just, no, you know, we're not plan on dropping a fare structure out of the sky on you, and we're planning on having more public opportunities, perhaps a public forum. We're going to present this to the FAA committee, and I'm sure there'll be opportunities for more public input, so we want to hear from everyone.
Okay.
First of all, I think I understand what you're saying about like the bus. I mean, I agree. I think because the bus, you only have people pack their cars once, it's hard to have a zone type or some sort of gradual repair. You can have an express system where you might have a local
With the rail system, the zone has to have now has 5 zones. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, on the weekend, okay, we currently have essentially a zone on the rail, on rail. There's essentially, there's three flexible fares on rail, and it's kind of a floating zone system where it depends on how far you're going, so it's not a fixed rate rail system. It's kind of more of a floating
zone.
Right. Has there been any consideration of taking the current weekend structure of these three kind of floating zones and extending that to weekday, increasing the weekday, doubling the weekend fare, or increasing the weekend fare by like 50%? Because that would be even simpler. And my understanding is that the weekend system also has like for instance, the entire Clarendon corridor is the lowest possible fare for anyone coming from pretty much anywhere in the district. The idea being that, I guess, Virginia wanted to incentivize people being able to get out to Clarendon, to go to restaurants, to go to shops, etc. And so I was just wondering if there was any, if there had been any thought towards taking that weekend fare structure and essentially just sort of coming with some sort of increment.
Sure.
Because that's it's a very straightforward, high, medium, low fare structure on the rail.
Right, and one way to think about that would be the possibility of maybe rounding our fares to $1, for example. What happens if we rounded our period fares to the nearest dollar? So instead of being $1.95, it would be $2. Instead of being $2.05, it would be $2. Instead of being $2.10, it would be $2. Right, so that way you end up with 5 fares, $2, $3, or $5, and then I don't know if it's worth it. That would be an option. That would be some of what you're referring to. Part of the issue is that the current fare structure, especially for the peak period fares, were the result of years of cross-jurisdictional coordination, collaboration, possibly a little argumentation of people really trying to feel like, that first slide that listed the fare structure, it's that way for a reason, and we're not at the point where we can just forget that reason and make us new. We want to make sure that we incorporate that reason as well that we're going forward. So I understand what you're saying, and the idea of maybe having 3 fares for the peak period, right? And again, the idea there is that some people are going to pay more, and some people are going to pay less. And would you be willing to be one of those people who go from paying $3.65 to $4?
I don't think a flat fare system for the rail system is going to go over here.
Yeah.
I appreciate that they have it in New York, at least in New York. I don't think it's going to sell here for a variety of reasons. I think that you have to differentiate between someone who's going from Shady Grove to Huntington and someone who is going from Chinatown to Woodland Park.
Right.
The system here is just kind of
kind of a hybrid between the subway and commuter rail.
Right.
And so, and even New York City's commuter rail system has zones.
Right.
Thank you for the one. Yeah. Good. And I like to thank you for the presentation. I really, because I'm from New York, I kind of like the flat fare. It's really easy. I mean, you go from Brooklyn to pay the same $2 and it doesn't matter. And I would like, if there is any consideration for flat fare, and with some of the other fares as well, they kind of rounded the numbers off. I like quarters, like $2.25, $2.75, Because even on the bus, if you don't have a smart car, you have to pay down 70, people are scrambling and losing money. They don't have the two dimes, so I would like to see it rounded off by quarters. And I agree with Diana, whatever you do for the peak fare, somebody's not going to like it. I still would like to see an off-peak fare. I would like to see a peak fare, maybe 275, maybe off-peak 175. I think
Just for clarifying, if we were to go to something flatter, we would want to make sure we maintain a peak fare versus an off-peak fare.
I would like to see both.
Right.
A peak and off-peak fare. Right. Even flat.
If we were to go flat, right. I mean, you don't want to be totally flat. You just want to.
Yeah,
want to make sure we have some sort of surcharge.
Right. So we do have an option. We do have a lot of tourists and other people who might prefer to travel during the off-peak time.
Or we may want them to travel.
Or you may want them.
We may want them on our escalator during the period.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. I just want to name this in it. I think it's terrific that we're getting to look at all of these options really early. You know, the budget's going to be debated in the spring. And, you know, a lot of the time in the past, it's in February and all of a sudden everyone's scrambling to talk about what to do. And, now we're going to get some analysis early on. I think, a lot of these are good. Some of them I don't like. One that, I think is on the second page, that this last page, about other concept that could be really appealing is sort of a tourist fair that is like a tourist's own, where, for $2.50, you get a paper, a paper fare card trip will take you anywhere within a kind of, half the system kind of zone. Not all the way to Shady Grove, because most of the time, the tourists aren't going there anyway, so you don't have to, they can do it for more. But like $2.50 gets you as far as Piston, Boston, and, Capitol Hill, and whatever.
That's kind of interesting.
Well, Ms. Agatha, thank you. You've certainly given us a lot to think about, and we have some time to think about it, too, before perhaps ordering a more formal response.
Okay.
We appreciate your friendly input. You're always welcome. Before we go on to the next topic, the next presentation, I just want to take a moment and notice that we have a visitor, Mr. James Dyke, the new board member from Virginia here, here with us. So I'd just like to welcome you to the Rise Advisory Council, Mr. Dyke. Thank you for coming. Our next presentation is on the Regional Transit System Plan, and we have with us the Director of the Department of Long Range Planning, Mr. Tom Harrington. Thank you for joining us.
Tonight we're talking about the Regional Transit System Plan, which is a project that's been underway for a couple of years to develop a new long-range transit plan for the region. Tonight I want to give you an overview of the project and talk about our status and where we are right now. I also want to get some ideas from you once you've heard what I'm going to describe about what should be in a long-range transit plan for the region. We did brief the Board of Directors about a year ago in the fall of 2010 on the project. You may be aware that the board is currently working on a strategic vision for Metro, and I think that ties in nicely with this project because the purpose of this project is to define what transit should be in the future, and then the board's work on a strategic vision will define what should Metro's role be in providing that future transit network. By way of background, the last time the board really took a look ahead at expanding the system was in 1999. That was at a point in which we were just about to finish completion of the original 103-mile system, and the board at that time was looking ahead and saying, what next for Metro? As noted here, there were multiple elements to it. It wasn't just expansion, it was also improving the access and the capacity of the system we have today, and improving bus services, adding new stations and entrances to sort of, again, get more out of the system we have. And then the fourth item was expanding the fixed guideway for premium transit. Also, along with that, they had two main goals. One was to double transit ridership in the region by 2025. The second was to add 50% more fixed guideway miles in the region. So those were two key goals at that time. Next slide. Current project is a 30-year plan, so it's a long-range look ahead, and it's looking at a multimodal transit system, one that has bus and metro rail like we have today, but also other modes such as streetcar and light rail and bus rapid transit we don't have yet in the region. It's operator neutral, meaning we're not just focused on metro rail, metro bus, or things that metro will definitely provide, but really all transit services, so then we can figure out metro's role once we've defined the network. It's supporting regional transportation goals that are established by COB, by the Transportation Planning Board, and in particular, last year when COB put out Region Forward, it set a vision for the type of communities that the region envisions, and we want our transit plan to come up with ideas on the transportation network that would serve those communities. And I think I just mentioned that our plan would be coordinated and support the board's current strategic planning effort. Next slide. Early in the project, we took a look at regional growth trends. And these are key inputs in any transportation study. So looking at the region's land use projections from up to 2040, we saw a region that's still growing and continues to grow. Although certainly the last couple of years after the recession has kind of slowed that process, but we do see long-term growth trends, and in particular, population growing 31%, employment growing closer to 40%, and part of that is because the region actually imports workers from outside. But really, it's where the growth's happening that we're most interested in, and different growth rates have an impact on the type of commuting people do. When we look at it broken out by the part of the region, we have the core, which is really downtown Washington and Arlington business districts. We then have central jurisdictions, which generally is inside the Beltway, so Arlington, Alexandria, and the rest of the District of Columbia. Inner suburbs would be the remainder of the Vermont Compact, so Montgomery, Prince George's, and Fairfax counties, and then outer suburbs would be the areas right around our service area that currently aren't part of the compact. When we look at growth in those areas, a couple of things that we're really interested in. One is trips going into downtown to the core are expected to grow by 12%, so considerably less than the overall growth in the region. And that's Metro's key market. The market we have the highest vote share on is growing, but obviously not as fast as the rest of the growth in the region. What is growing quite a bit is suburban travel, growing by 45% in that time period. And the key challenge for transit is how do we serve those suburban trips that are usually most difficult for us to serve because they have an area that may not be as walkable as downtown. So, we organized the study initially focused on four issue areas. The first is core capacity, and really this is looking at the trips I just talked about, the trips to the center of the region. Do we have enough capacity to serve those trips? And this is particularly important not only for people that work in the core, but really for trips that will pass through the core as well, because with transit services, it may be someone wants to go from Prince George's County to Arlington or Fairfax. They're going to pass through the core, so the capacity in the center of the region is critical to trips both to and through the core. Access, we're talking about here in the context of how do people get to rail, how do people get to bus. Right now, our parking facilities are fairly full. We generally have good bus access to our stations, but it can be expensive. We could do more with it. But there are limitations on perhaps what we can afford on that. We're really trying to promote bike and pedestrian access to stations because that's, of course, the most cost-effective way to get people there. But that means that there has to be more development around those stations. When we look at our service transit corridors, meaning the bus system right now, and then in the future, streetcar and light rail, key issue is traffic congestion. Every year, with more and more traffic added to the region's roadways, it makes it more costly and difficult for us to operate the bus system. What does that mean in the future if we keep adding traffic? What it could mean, it's hard to sustain the bus service we have today, and that's a key issue we want to address. And then the last part is sort of new markets. Where are those centers around the region that don't have connections to the rest of the region, and how can we connect to those? The next slide sort of arrays a bunch of strategies, which are types of improvements that we're looking at. I'm going to kind of go through those in a little more detail in the following slide. So, again, we kind of follow the four issues that I just went through. I need to kind of flavor the things we've looked at so far. So, going on, the other thing is, to date, while we've evaluated these, we've done forecasts of who would use the services, the ridership, but we've also tried to evaluate the benefits of different strategies, and this is just giving you a feel for using kind of a consumer reports look, pretty high level, what are things that improve and what are things that maybe don't make much of a difference when we've tested the strategies around some key areas. And this is something we're still looking at as we move ahead with the study, what are the measures we should be using. So that's another area that I welcome input on. Well, we'll go on to the next. The key issue area is port capacity. The major issue that I think we've talked about this group in the past is at some point, if we continue to grow, even with line-haul car training, we will reach peak capacity on the system. Depending on which forecast we look at, it'll happen before 2040, and again, it'll sort of, customers will experience congested conditions even before we reach capacity. What we also found is that it's not just running long trains frequently, it's also with stations that have capacity issues. And some of those we've experienced already, particularly our major transfer points like Gowrie Place and Metro Center and Long Hill Plaza. And often when we talk about capacity, we remind people that we had a good test run of this on inauguration day in 2009, where we did carry over 1.2 million rail riders in one day. That's, again, the types of projections we're looking at for 2030, 2040. What would be that be like, you know, on a regular basis? And what we did find is it was often the station capacity that broke down first. So that's going to be a key area that we need to look at. Getting into stations, transferring, you know, moving up and down escalators, that kind of thing. So in terms of strategies to address core capacity, the biggest impact, of course, the most expensive, would be new rail. Should we look at new rail lines through downtown? And we're going to do that. Prior studies have all said, you know, the best thing to do would be separate lines where we're currently interlining. So separate the orange and the blue, separate the yellow and green, and we get full capacity out of all those lines. And so we looked at a bunch of variations on just that principle of separating lines. We also looked at interline connections, so looking to add flexibility to the system. Currently in places where trains can't take a left turn or right turn, what if we added connections to promote the different service patterns? And some of the examples were, you know, connecting Courthouse and Arlington cemeteries or bypassing Rockland to keep trains in Virginia, looking at sort of adding to that a connection that would sort of go past the Pentagon and allow people from, say, the New Silver Line to have a direct trip to the east side of downtown. And also another connection would be, you know, having connections to the Green Line, the main yard area directly. We were looking at all these variations. I think they're all somewhat limited by feasibility and cost. And the problem is anytime you interline, you have to have the system has to be well coordinated so that trains can come together and operate reliably. We explore that. And then finally, with core capacity, bus and streetcar and light rail potentially could be another way to add to our capacity. Don't focus just on that rail, but another way to bring people to the core. Next slide is on access. The key issues here. First is the cost of parking and the difficulty of expanding parking. Since the system opened, really since the beginning, 1976, most of our parking lots have been full, you know, early in the morning, and particularly in Northern Virginia, really all over the system, we have near 100% utilization of parking. So there's clearly a demand, there's always been a demand for parking, but parking's expensive to provide, it takes time, we're not right around the station. And it has another impact on us, which is it's very peaked in terms of when the lots fill up. In many stations, you might have a lot of fill up at 8 a.m. pretty much every day. What that means is, the last half hour before that lot fills up, everyone arrives, and we have a very peaked demand, which means we have full trains, we have to put out more capacity. So that's the downside of parking. The positive on parking is that it provides access to a much wider area, so people far away from the system can get there. What we do find when we look is that at many of our stations, a majority or many of the customers come from not too far away. They certainly come from within a bike distance in a lot of cases. And we also find a lot of stations where we have 100% coming from less than a mile that are parking. And they're typically coming in one person per car. So there's an opportunity there to get more use out of our spaces, either by getting people to share rides at stations, but also to maybe add options so that people closer have other ways to get to the station. And parking is the means for people coming from longer distances. So we looked at improving the pedestrian environment on stations, how to get people to the system. We looked at new options for parking rides. So instead of clustering all the parking right at the station, maybe we look at satellite parking that's further away that's connected by shuttle bus operations. And we also looked at infill stations. There are opportunities to do what we did at New York Avenue and insert a new station into the system. On the next slide, looking at what we're calling surface transit. I already mentioned the key issue of traffic congestion. Another issue is regional integration. So, as you're probably aware, there are a lot of proposals in the region for streetcar and light rail. The District of Columbia has an ambitious plan for streetcar network. There's Columbia Pike in Arlington, Purple Line, and Port City Transitway in Maryland. So, there are a number of projects being planned and have been planned for over 10 years in a number of these quarters. What we've tried to do is start to talk to the different parties, because what's happening is these parts are being planned separately, and there's no regional standard for how the projects would integrate. There's no plans to have them work together as a system, and so we're looking at that just in a parallel effort to this. So really in the future, streetcar, light rail, and bus improvements are all ways that we can provide higher quality transit. And then the last strategy was, group of strategies was looking at new connections. And really here this is saying, where are there kind of missing links in the network? Places where providing high quality, fixed guideway services would improve transportation. And then going to the COG Region 4 document, connecting the region's top 20 or 30 activity centers is a key goal. So we're really looking at how to connect those. And in addition to light rail and bus, we're also looking at extensions. There's been a lot of proposals to extend metro rail much longer distances to places like the BWI Airport, to Prince William County, to Bowie. So we're certainly looking at those. We're also looking at them as well, maybe these could be commuter rail connections or bus connections. So looking at extending the reach of the system without necessarily focusing exclusively on just one mode. And so that was kind of a feel for the types of things we have looked at today. Where we are is basically right in the middle of the study. So we've completed sort of the first two major boxes. We've sort of laid out our key issues we're trying to address and our goals. We've been working with the technical advisory group, the other representatives from all jurisdictions. We've been supporting the effort. We've done some initial testing of some strategies. And sort of just trying to summarize those results and we'll have that available. But really we're at kind of midway, and what we want to do next is take these pieces and decide how to put them in possible scenarios for the future that we'll then bring to the board and to the public and to you all sort of to look at some possible future scenarios. So we have been doing some updates, you may be aware we have a blog. I started this project, which covers a lot of planning topics, called planetmetro.com. The URL on the next page there. As I mentioned, we're working with the board on our strategic visioning, and as they're ready to sort of get public input on what they're doing, we hope to sort of talk about the future of the Regional Transit Network at the same time as part of that effort. And really going in spring and summer of 2012, we'd like to sort of get some consensus around what should be in this long-range plan. So it's a good time to really just sort of ask the question, is there anything we're missing, you haven't seen here, that should, that is critical to the long-range plan? And then if you had to, you know, to design a future network of your dreams or future, what would be in it? And how would you, you know, if you had the group of, say, maybe one scenario would be, you know, a high investment level, another one that's more modest, what would be the key things you would need to? Those are the kind of questions we're asking. And we can start a discussion tonight, but obviously it's one that, you know, these are big questions, so kind of welcome your ongoing input as we continue to study. So at this time, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, and thank you, RACS members, on that last go around for keeping reaching. Let's do the same on this one.
Yes. I have a question about linking heavy rail, something that's been suggested before of MARC and VRE coordinating more and heavy rail connection maybe experimentally between Silver Spring and King Street. Is that in your purview?
I don't think we tested the third money in this initial set. It's definitely something that we could look at. Sort of the demand for that and how many people make those trips. From previous studies, what we found is that the attractions tend to be closer to the middle region. So, you know, Silver Spring to Crystal City or something to the Pentagon, you know, clearly that's where people are engaged. But you're right, it would help a lot, potentially with port capacity, would maybe be the biggest benefit. So the problem with having a Union Station, if you could just get people to stay on trains a few more stops, it might help some of the kind of
thanks. Real quick here, the access board is getting comments right now on public rights of way access advisory regulations that they close on November 23rd. What they entail are increasing pedestrian and bicycle access for properties and what that should entail. I assume that you guys are aware of that. Those comments and how that would impact the areas around metro stations and sidewalks and bicycling and all that. You mentioned that several times. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen those comments. We certainly have recently done our own bicycle and pedestrian improvements plan, and we'll be putting out some recommended improvements in the next few weeks as well. But
the site is Access Hatton Board at
Okay.
So they're looking for comments, but certainly they have the NPRM out there, and it would be, I'm sure what they come up with is going to impact some of the stuff that's going to be done. So it's a good thing to know.
Okay.
Just a quick question. It's truly a question. To me, one of the big design flaws of the metro system was that they didn't put in three rails, so that when one rail went down, they could still be running in two directions, or during rush hour, they could have two trains running one direction and one running the other. That seemed to be a real basic design flaw. And one thing that isn't here, and it strikes me it may not be any more expensive than extensions, because we know what the Dulles extension is costing. Is there any consideration to try to add a third rail? I'm particularly concerned about this when you say that peak capacity will be reached in 2040. I assume peak capacity in 2040 means you can't carry any more passengers. Is there any consideration to adding a third rail, expanding the tunnels and adding a third rail?
I think at this point that kind of a retrofit would be cost prohibitive. But what we are, and I think the other issue we have, unlike some systems that are truly radio, like, you know, MARC or VRE, come into downtown and they park at Union Station and they go back out later in the day. But all of our lines are through lines, meaning we go in both directions and sort of a peak direction on some part. So as a result, you know, we did two tracks in one direction, one back, and we have an imbalance. So
that's one other piece of our system. However, I think where you're going with that is we recognize it really affects reliability having a two-track system if you have a disabled train. In the short term, we certainly try to put as many crossovers in the system as possible so that we can get trains around the stalled train. But one of the things that we looked at when we looked at new lines, like the yellow and so forth, would be, you know, rather than adding a third or fourth track to the current yellow line, what if we took the yellow line and moved it over two blocks and separated the yellow and the green? Particularly the yellow, because of the shorter section, you know, between Longfond to Mount Square, maybe there's a potential, you know, we're going to retrofit the current tunnel, but add another parallel tunnel, may end up being more cost effective. We could certainly, a point that gets raised a lot, about our system compared to New York or others, who maybe have that flexibility.
Okay, thank you.
I just have a real quick question. When you talk about separating the lines and putting them in different places in order to get full use of the line, theoretically that implies that replacing where those lines are doubled up at with more trains to you so that you don't increase the headways. Right now where the orange line and the blue line run together, the headway is shorter because there are two trains that you take. So if you take one of the trains away, then you increase the headway in between there. But then, doesn't that also go into that, well, we're already kind of at our capacity with electricity, with Metro hitting this electricity wall, and not having enough, basically enough power to continue to expand the number of trains that will run. And then the last, while you think about that, the last thing that I just wanted to mention about parking lots and things like that. Because I live in Cheverly and I know there are a lot of people who live just right up the hill in the park at the parking lot over there. Maybe one thing that we could have talked about with the other gentleman was de-incentivizing parking for people who park who live closer, so that basically is raising the fare on parking at the Metro. In the Metro parking lot, I know for some people, especially from Virginia and Maryland, that's a no-man's land, but that's probably one way to get people to carpool more to parking lots, or not when you just live up the hill, park in the parking lot.
On the issue of pricing and parking, it's something that certainly has been talked about, discussed, and particularly if we have a revenue shortfall, I'm sure price of parking will come up as part of that. I mean, the one thing about if we raise the price of parking is it does sort of encourages carpooling automatically. In other words, if you pay more, you want to share it with someone else. I think that where you get a lot of concerns would be, you know, people who really don't have the option of sharing a ride, they have to get to a station. And what we often hear is, you know, if you go right now, it makes sense to ride Metro, but if you raise parking $1 or $2, then suddenly I'm going to look at driving downtown because I can look at the price of parking downtown. And so we have to always keep that in our mind that, you know, for commuter trips, our competitor is the automobile in terms of someone's vehicle price. But it's a good point about addressing shortages. On the issue of capacity, it's true. There are many dimensions of capacity. We talked about first is running longer trains. To run 8-car trains, we need more rail cars. We need to upgrade power, like we're saying. We need to find places to store the cars. So those are all things we're looking at, actually, really in the next 5 to 10 years, is we want to ramp up the e-car train. Those will be issues in the future. The other thing that I guess your comment about, are we kind of maxed out some sections in terms of the frequency of trains, raises another good point. A finding we didn't expect at a study that we've already sort of seen it. We did a lot of tweaking of the Metrail line, and I included some of the pictures in the appendix. In particular, the one that has all the new rail lines with the core,
slide 16, okay.
So here's graphically showing you the effect of the rail line connections that we explored, including separating the blue and orange and separating the yellow and the green. But particularly looking at, say, like the new blue line, which has been studying other trains. We add, you know, the missing Georgetown station, and we did this, you know, new tunnel across Roslyn,
But then, there are two approaches we looked at for the blue line. One would be, on the left, is something that sort of dips down and serves parts of downtown that don't have rail service, in particular here around the State Department. And, you know, it sort of follows Constitution Avenue, and then it comes back up to connect to Union Station. Another approach on the right is one that just kind of follows N Street Northwest across town and sort of, again, sort of Georgetown, but then sort of serves the northern half of downtown better. Both those lines then sort of east of Union Station would serve sort of northeast, H Street Northeast corridor, Benning Road corridor, and then would sort of pick up with the existing blue line across the east of the river. But given these an example, one of the things we found that we didn't really expect was just how well the current system performs. So no matter all the tweaking that we do here, what you find is really how brilliant the current design is, that both in terms of serving areas efficiently, and then the practice of having airlines so that the areas that need more frequency get it, because we bring two lines together when we need more service. But really, whenever we tried moving lines around like the blue and the yellow, we just didn't get big ridership gains, because for most people, they actually have pretty good access currently. So at this point, the incremental improvements are a little more modest relative to the cost, because we have very good rail service in some parts of the downtown. So that was kind of an interesting finding, I think, so far. These do have big impacts on capacity, which is kind of one of the goals.
My question is regarding the surface transit strategies regarding the light rail, the proposed light rail, and streetcars and what have you. I understand that they are all being developed independently, but at some point, have they contacted you, Metro, regarding, because at least the one I'm familiar with is the Columbia Pike, and Columbia Pike is designed to start, the starting point to be Pentagon City Metro Station. So it seems to me that they have been in contact with, Metro regarding that. I don't know about the others, but since they should be coordinated.
They have been coordinating with us, and in fact, for Columbia Pike and for the DC streetcar, Metro for many years has been either in a supporting role or the lead planner on both those projects at various times. And as well as the Purple Line, we've been a key project partner. I think what we are trying to do now is to get them to talk to each other. So, should Columbia Pike look at connections across the river to connect to DC streetcar? If they do make connections with that, should they be using similar vehicles that maybe could be maintained in a shared facility? Will they use the same fare cards so the customers can go between different lines? Will customers expect the same kind of information, next train arrival information? Will they come to Metro's trip planner to plan a trip, and will they expect to see all those lines in the trip planner so that, you don't really care who's running the train, you just want to be able to get on the region. I think that is the principle of what we're trying to do with integration. And so in the last year, we've had some very good working groups established with representatives from all the projects to talk about maintenance, potential shared maintenance ideas, fair integration ideas, customer information ideas. I think we're making some progress.
Thank you for your presentation. I have a suggestion. I think that these are all good ideas. I think in the long run, certainly some of the road improvements will make sense. But I think in the short term, there's something else that can be done. And that's just to give more priority to the bus network. I just feel like that's probably going to be least costly, and you can get a lot more people on there. And I think one of the things that might actually help that cause is to actually get a new PR campaign to make the bus sexy, so to speak. And to work with Omada to do that, and also work with Omada to make routes that better reflect people's work patterns and leisure patterns that they do today and not 20 or 30 years ago. I'm one of those people that live a mile from the Metro station. I live a mile from the Yellow Road Metro. I never walk to the Yellow Road Metro. I always drive. Do you know why? Because it's not safe for me to walk to the Yellow Road Metro. poorly lit. The curb is, or the sidewalk is right on the curb of the road, it's at 15 feet back to give me some type of buffer with the vehicle traffic. And also, I don't know, and this is one of the best stations, but I don't really know if the cab's going to be there. So if I have an event where I need to stay late at work, it's not like I can say, okay, I know if I hit the middle of the road, I'll get a cab. There are usually cabs there, but I can't say 90% sure, yes, there will be a cab if I need one at 11 o'clock at night when I'm returning home. So I'd like to also see you all work more so with the, I guess the cab, I don't know where the cab commissions are in Maryland, Virginia, D.C., because that can be another option. I'd love to walk to the metro station. Right now, it's just not really an option for me. Also, one other reason I don't walk is because it takes me one bus to get to Naylor Road Metro during rush hour. Every 20 minutes, I have to walk 3 blocks to get there. Or if it's not during rush hour, it takes me 2 buses, and it takes 45 minutes. And I have to be honest, time is money. I can spend $1.50 and an hour to get to a train station, or I can drive my car and just pay.
Well, okay, first I'm just going to say thank you for the good presentation, and it was a ton of information, and I could probably talk to you for an hour about it. Secondly, because Kelsey and I are always the same, I'm just going to reiterate what she said, which is distance does not equate with walkability or bikeability. You can be 100 yards from something, and if between you and that destination is an interstate freeway, you can't walk there. And also, it's not just a matter of whether or not there's a sidewalk. When people are going to work to professional desk jobs in this area, when 3 or 4 months out of the year, walking 2 blocks down the street, you are dripping in sweat. The reality is walking isn't always feasible for people who have to wear dress clothes to work. You need to have things like good bus options. You know, buses that go by during rush hour every 5 minutes. You have that in places in this country. Bus routes that will run every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, every 20 minutes in the middle of an urban area during rush hour, during the week when people are trying to get to work, is absurd. The frequency of bus service in many parts of this area is simply laughable. Okay? If you want people to take the bus places, if you want people to skip the car, you have to get the bus service to a point that's reasonable for a metropolitan area of this size, where as many people in the workforce as we have here have desk jobs that require dress clothes. You just have to do it, because otherwise people aren't going to really, they don't really have a choice. They're going to have to drive because they can't stand outside at 7:30 in the morning when it's already 85 degrees in dress clothes, waiting, you know, 20 minutes for a bus that shows up every 35.
The point about priority and treatment for bus, maybe make that more feasible. If the bus moves faster than the rest of the cars.
Walking isn't always, biking isn't always going to be feasible. And if you want to start talking about what you need to do to make biking feasible in this area, biking to destinations, including rail stations, I mean, facilities just aren't there. Like, not even by 10%. I'm sorry, trying to get up, but I think you need to completely ramp up the access in a way that I don't think people are even starting to think about right now. And you can't just talk about it in terms of distance. That's just really not fair.
I love page 51. We talked about Metro X extensions in my area, which I'm in the Prince George's County area, and right now everyone who lives in Waldorf parks at the Ranch Avenue of the Metro because there's no rail extension there. But on this photo, I'm assuming that would be a Green Line extension. Page 51, where the next Vice Chairman of the Green Line Extension and Boogie would be, is that going to be a blue or an orange?
It's actually been looked at in both the blue and the orange.
And do you have any timeline for these two expansions?
I think the first stage here was just to see what kind of ridership, you know, who would use this kind of a line. And then, you know, the next stage we'll be talking about feasibility and cost effectiveness.
Okay.
There's no time on hand.
And to piggyback on what Kelsey was saying, Mail Road Station is a hub, and it only has less than 400 parking spaces there. I've always been concerned about that. I mean, there's some areas around it that kind of subject, they could subject from, particularly across the street. I know I would drive there, I was parked there, but I worked off hours, so by the time I get there, everything is full. As I said, that's a major hub there. We do have the bus, the county bus. The problem with that is it stops at 7. So if you are out past 7 o'clock, you can't take that bus. So if they can even extend those hours, I think that people, because they aren't able to bus it, you have more people, you know, able to use even that bus. I mean, I would prefer to do that as well. So I really think you have a hub station such as Mail Road that should be
We never went to number 7, public hearing recap or comments. We just put this on the agenda to have time. If any of you were at public hearings and wanted to provide any feedback from them, from those meetings, you now have time to do so. This is one in Prince George's County in Hyattsville. And they were very brief meeting as far as the meetings go, and mostly concerning one group, the R3 group. John has informed me that the staff are already taking a lot of the feedback from those meetings into the plan restructuring. So are there any other anecdotes or comments from the meetings?
On the metro access side, there were 3 public hearings on the 24th, 25th, 26th, and they were very well attended, about 50 people in each hearing. Wamata's putting comments together on those hearings. But what on the metro access side, what I did hear, what we all heard, and I attended 2 of those hearings, was that there were issues concerning scheduling, somewhat to do with fair policy that I think we've covered a little bit tonight. And then the third was dispatchers. So interesting what you guys were, you know, what this committee was holding hearings. We also, on the AAC side of the metro access, also had hearings. Very well attended, very well. A lot of people to speak, a lot of passion, very well conducted. And we've got good information for the current metro access contract. And I think what they want to try to do also is to take this information, again, that's critical to disabled people, move it into the new contract that we're going to have in the summer of 2013 for Paragraph.
Thank you.
Awesome.
I just wanted to say that I attended the public hearing. I was helping in Acacia along with Diana was there, and I thought that it was well attended, and I really appreciated that. Ward 7 and Ward 8 in D.C. and some other D.C. residents got to speak out, not just about the proposed changes that were in the docket, but just about, in general, their ridership experience. And what it made me think of was, well, my gosh, had it not been for these hearings, there are some people that might not be comfortable sending an email or might not be comfortable calling, but this was a more face-to-face dialogue that they could have, and they could show their passion for their bus being crowded or operating not being as friendly as possible or being authorization not being open long enough when the purchase passes. So I was just wondering if maybe, I don't know what the RAC can do, if we want to consider making some type of suggestion where maybe we're not officials or maybe not the board are more available and accessible to the public in these type of meeting formats. I don't know how often that should happen, but it just occurred to me that outside of these hearings, when we can change or make a fair change or route change, that we don't, that the public doesn't really get to talk to those that work at making these
I don't think it fits in here. I attended the public hearing in Montgomery County in Bethesda on escalators at the Bethesda station. WAMU was present, provided, I think, the coverage that probably is archived. I'll try and find that and send it to John. Of course, they actually did sit me down on one of the panels. I was mercifully brief. I did make the point, though, that the same situation had occurred much less often at Wheaton, and it's a substantially longer climb from the tracks at Wheaton. So I'll try. There was also coverage on other outlets, but I think I can find the WAMU in New York.
Any other comments?
Okay.
I was just going to tune in and say that Lorraine and I overlooked at the Arlington bus service changes hearing, and I think it was very positive that it was in the community board that was touched by the proposed bus service changes. And that it was probably actually one of the most positive hearings I've attended. because the people were pretty in favor of the changes. So very positive action.
Well, thank you for all those comments. We'll now move on to questions and comments on the RAC chair and AAC chair reports. And you also had the email that I forwarded about Chris Schmidt's information request. So are there any questions or comments?
You're asking about the chair report and the request?
Well, it was all in one package.
If it's appropriate, I would like to offer my motion.
Sure.
Thank you all for your patience on the email exchange. I don't have the intention to repeat that unless anyone would like me to. But I would like to move, as I mentioned in my email, that we express our disappointment to the board and the response that we've received to those requests. And that we appeal what we've been told to the full board. And as I mentioned, I won't really repeat it other than to say that I think this is really an issue to stand on principle on. This is the first test of the new policy that was adopted in the bylaws, and these are very important issues to many, many riders that affect literally every rider every day. So I would move that for the five reasons that I mentioned in my email, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Trustee seconds the motion. Is there any discussion? Veronica?
I did not jump in on the email, but I would like to comment that I do think that we have two organizations that have to work with each other, live with each other, and I do think there has to be a procedure for making these kinds of requests, or we're going to get bad reactions out of the board, and that gives me a lot of concern that we may be building bad relations with the board. So I will go back to something that was, I know, controversial a few times ago, and that is, I think we do need some kind of screening process that doesn't prevent people from asking for information, but if it's going to be controversial at all, that come before this group and be discussed before it goes to the board. So I guess I am opposed to the motion.
Sorry, interesting.
Hi. I'm not clear, again, with the history of this. You said it's been going on for a year. Can we get a little background on that?
Sure. Very briefly, when I came on board in January, I made a request very similar to this. It languished for about three months. Then we moved into the process of considering the bylaw changes, which took a few more months. Immediately after that was enacted, I filed this new request, which was similar to the old one. It has now languished for several months, and that brings us to today.
When you say languished, you mean
Can I just clarify that I think Christy made your first request in February, and I you got an answer, and that was no. I if that's unclear.
No, I never actually did get an answer. I was just ignored.
Okay. And then this month, or this time around, you requested in early September, and I think the response came, I guess it was last week or the beginning of last week?
About 7 weeks.
Okay, fair enough. Language is fine, but there has been a response. Okay, I just as long, I didn't see any email traffic today, so I just want to make sure that's clear.
I don't oppose the request for the information. I think that in theory it should be public information. Fine. I think though that what I took from the email back from
the board secretary?
Yes. The board secretary is that they are offering you had a new presentation. Our initial question is what methods they use to measure one-time performance. And they have offered presentation on that. And then I would think that should be our first step, is to allow them the opportunity to come and do that presentation first, ask our questions there, and then see if there's other information that we need that they did not present before we, I think that Rick said the tone of this can become overly aggressive at some point, and it can be just being uncompromising, and not taking what they're trying to ask us. And I also took from the secretary's letter that she was actually inviting us to revisit the discussion about how these decisions are made, how these requests are made. And I think that that's something that we started, and unfortunately, we decided to discontinue. And so I think that that's something that we probably should do again and present it to the board and ask them, do you agree with the way that we would like to make these requests? So I would like to go that route first. I don't think that, Chris, you should have information. I don't think we should have information. I just think that they offered an olive branch. It's not what we want, so we should probably take that before we go to the other group.
Okay, David. And then I have Carol Kelsey then.
Thanks. I actually agree very much with what Joseph said. It's very disappointing that they said no to this request. When we were talking to John and we were going through that bylaw procedure, John said that the general counsel said that they kind of thought that the metro should have complied with the request in the first place. So, you know, the fact that everyone's being secretive, especially about the first part, which is this sort of data about how on time the trains are, you know, it doesn't seem to me to make sense that they would be so secretive. And when the performance folks were here a few months ago, I think several people in this group kind of got the sense that they were, you know, being a little resistant to us wanting to ask questions that kind of delve below the surface. And like, well, how did you cope with this? And can you give us more information? I just think that if we are going to, when I met with a board member actually in the last meeting and kind of said something to them kind of along the lines of what I just said, and that person essentially was like, yeah, that seems like a good point. Like, why is Metro being why is this particular office, you know, performance office being so secretive? So when we kind of explain it that way, like, this is what we're trying to do, and this is the way the response we get, I think then we get a favorable reaction from the board. But if we just kind of say to them, you know, we should be able to get this stuff because their app is inherently entitled to make this request, you know, with no justification, period, then they're going to be, you know, they're not necessarily going to be on our side. So I just think we need to come up with the next explanation for why what we want to do is going to advance our rider goal, and maybe try to work with the staff to accomplish it in some other ways. You know, I'm just saying, like, give us the data. No, well, here's the data, or else, no, you're about to give us the data. You know, like, we're not getting in with this particular approach, but, like, let's find some other approaches and build a case. And once we build up a case, we're like, really, we were trying to understand this thing. This is why it's good for riders. We tried this, we got rebuffed. We tried that, we got rebuffed. Look at all this. I think then we get a very sympathetic response from the board, assuming that we don't get anywhere. And if we get somewhere with staff, then great, then we've accomplished our goal.
Yeah, mine's really a point of information. I've read the email preference, but what's the bylaw change that we're talking about? I was confused about that.
That was a bylaw change. That was a board bylaw
right.
change.
Okay, it was not a council.
Bylaw creation, actually.
Yeah, right. The bylaw creation. Okay. And for some reason, we looked at it, right?
We asked them to include something about how the board expects staff to give us information to watch from this.
Okay. My comment is that I agree with what Joseph and David said essentially, that I think that we need to revisit how we approach the board, because my concern is there's no way in the world that I call up and say, I want to come meet with you, or I want to do this. We have an extra punch there because we're going to the rack. So I think we need to revisit just how we present ourselves and request information and when it needs to come before the rack. And it seems to me that this would kind of request
such a little, you know, business department, and we need to all be aware of it before it's being submitted in our names.
Well, two clarifications that Carol wanted, but it wasn't submitted in the correct name. And we, we had, as has already been said, we had discussed a procedure, and at that point, it didn't seem to be a need for it. Maybe now at this point, it does seem, you know, with experience, it does seem to be a need for some sort of procedure. Chelsea?
Sure. I believe I read all of the email exchanges. I think I got most of them right. And I think I have a pretty good understanding of the papers different people were coming from. Having served on the RAC for about 6 years or so, I can say that since I've been here, to me, there's always been an issue with getting more information from WMATA than what they just want to present to us, or what they just, I feel they just want to present to me. And so while this request was for the train, I would like to see, I guess, where this request goes in case I have similar questions or similar digging that I'd like to do for the bus network. I didn't take the response from the board secretary as being one where we will present to you and then maybe we can negotiate the scope of your request or how we can tweak it some so that it's more palatable to us. I just took it as we'll present to you again what we presented to you in the past, and maybe you'll have a better understanding of it. Not that we'll get you the information so that you as an independent body and independent thinkers who might think differently than the executives at WMATA might be able to look at this info and not necessarily point out anything bad or good, but be able to look at it just in a different way than we look at it every day. Keep telling me the bus is on time, and I know the bus is not on time. So I don't want to make this a difficult issue. I don't want to burn any bridges. I want to make sure that the relationship we have with the board stays pleasurable and is a productive one. And so, but I think also that this is, we tried to come up with a way for what, 2 or 3 meetings now in the late summer, early fall, with how to handle requests like this. And it was like the conversation was just going round and round. But now this is a premier case, and we really need to work this out. Because there are going to be, I think, more cases like this. If we really want to be effective to the rival public, there's certain data that we need, and there's a certain trust and an understanding that, and respect level that we need from the board with what we're going to do with that type of information.
Okay.
Diana,
and then David, and Carol,
are
you
asking me again? Yeah. All right, well, first I'd just like to say that, you know, when this group was created, when you look at the original, like, resolution that created the group that the board had, it didn't necessarily grant the RAC or any of its individual members any access to data beyond that which the public had. The purpose of the group was to be sort of an almost external body, and we're not staffed, we're not paid, we don't have access to anything anyone else has. Having said that, and I will agree with all the folks who said we've had situations where I've asked for very sort of vanilla information, had a hard time getting it. And I will say that I have actually gone to board members and said things like, do I need to file a FOIA to get this information? And that started to shake things up because I don't think they want to create that kind of dynamic where it gets around that RAC members had to file a FOIA to get the information that they wanted. But having said that, in terms of getting RAC support and my support behind asking for this information as a group, I'm not understanding from reading the email what the outcome is that we're going for here. Why are we asking for this information, and where do we see this going? What are we going to do with it? What's the game plan? What's the take home? You know, what's touchdown with this request? I mean, because I don't think that we want to get in a situation of asking for information just to ask for it. And I'm not saying that's what we're doing. I guess I'm just saying that I'm not kind of picking up from going through the emails what we're going to actually say when we get this. So that would kind of help me if someone could articulate, you know, where we're going with this request.
Well, as I mentioned in one of my notes back, it's not possible to say now what the outcome is because it's preliminary research. My aim was to do preliminary research on a matter that might come before the RAC later. But as to specifically a recommendation or when might show, that of course would be pending any kind of analysis of the information. What we do know going in is that there are two very crucial issues where Metro has not been forthcoming. And my attitude or my belief is that we have the right on behalf of our constituents to look at those. But to answer your question briefly, no, can't say now what the ultimate outcome is going to be, because as you know, that's how preliminary research works.
I was going to ask a different question, but I guess I'd sort of like to hear Mark and Chris about this. I mean, I can guess what would make me want that information. Is there a reason you don't want to say what is the reason that you think that this particular issue is one that you want to do preliminary research on? Because, like, why do you think that real-time data is something that you want to do preliminary research on and not the kind of paint that they use, you know, in the stations? I mean, just, I think it would just help, I'm not trying to say trick away, I think it would help all the other members if you could explain why you would zero down these particular issues and what you hypothesize might come out.
Sure, I'd be happy to, thank you. In the case of the on-time data, well, actually, let me back up. In the case of both things, I purposely tried to be a little bit obtuse about what the end result is or what my interest is, because I didn't want to prejudge the situation. I didn't want to say, for example, I want to get this data because I want to prove that such and such. I think that's an unfair way to go about research. Since you ask, however, I'll answer. And that is, I flat out don't believe the on-time data that Metro publishes. And I wish to conduct analysis of the raw data in order to see whether what they're doing makes sense. If it makes sense, great, no rat issue. If it doesn't make sense, rat issue. In the case of automatic train control and collision avoidance, can there be any more basic issue to driver safety? And yet, over the past couple of years since the accident, Metro has been all over the map in saying what its plans are, in saying what its findings are, and in saying when it's likely that automatic train control will return. So I want to see the data. I want to see some of the internal dialogue. Again, if everything appears fine, in my view, as a preliminary researcher, and an RACU, if it ever comes there, great. If not, however, there's a RAC issue. So, I was trying not to prejudge the issues, but those are my beginning thoughts going in.
I would say this is my biggest problem with this, since the initial request did say you're using this for right purposes, is that you were going to use it for your personal research, and then if nothing came of it, you didn't plan to share it with us. And that's my bigger problem, you're requesting it on behalf of the group, but not necessarily going to share it with us unless you found something that you thought may consider merit it.
If the implication is, was I intending to hide something, certainly no. It's simply a matter of time. If the preliminary work showed that, you know, from my perspective as a requester, there was no issue, then of course I would not bring no issue to this group. Think of it, if you will, as just a screen on it. If the screen doesn't show anything, it just wouldn't go any further. It would just die at that point. As for making it in the name of the RAC or not, I made the request as an individual who happens to be a RAC member. If you go back and look at the request, I didn't identify myself as acting on behalf of the RAC.
Your initial paragraph said, I'm requesting this for RAC purposes.
Insofar as I'm a RAC member, sure.
I didn't hear, I guess, Victoria, what you heard, which was using this for personal reason or personal gain. What I heard is that in the field of science that I'm used to, which is if you have an open repository of data where everyone can go and can analyze it, if there's something worth publishing, you go ahead and publish that finding. If it's not, if there's nothing there and it's not worthy to the public, you leave it alone and you walk away and you go search something else. So I look at it as something where I want access to this data. If something comes of it, I'll let you know. If something doesn't come of it, I'll let you know too, and we'll leave it alone. And I think that's really important to have. And I think you can put stipulations on it. I think you can let the board know that this information will stay within the confines of just the RAC, or these three or four individuals, if you don't want the whole world to know. but I think to not give us access to it, or not, you know, just put again constraints on it to say, we're not going to give it to you for the whole year, we'll give it to you for 3 months, something to start with, so that we can have a really intelligent dialogue. I'm in the same place that you are, because I know how the same data that you have, instead of just what you're presenting to me in a scenario.
I can only understand that, that makes sense. I just think if this issue was more important and you requested as a RAC member, you requested this in February and we haven't heard anything about it. You're only coming to the group because they denied your request and you want our support now. So I'm just not getting the full picture here. That's just my opinion.
Steve?
Yeah, I support this amendment, and I mean, this is an imperfect analogy, but for a representative body, claim to be representing constituents. If we're asking for information from a government agency, they have to have a pretty good reason not to give it. And regardless of the personal reasons or within the RAC or a member who's also on RAC, it doesn't really matter. They have to be responsive to reasonable requests for information, and if not, give very specific reasons not to.
Just a quick comment. I find it a little strange that this is not a request for the RAC. This fight is not for the RAC, but the RAC is very upset that the RAC didn't get the information for the RAC. So it seems there's a certain disconnect here, that for us to send a letter saying the RAC is upset that the RAC didn't get its information, but we're just told it's not requested by the RAC. So, again, I think this highlights the need for procedure, and if we're going to be that upset about something, it seems like we ought to be upset with them denying a letter from our chairman on behalf of the RAC board, not on denying it for an individual. So again, I see a certain disconnect here.
Was there a letter from you there?
No.
No, he was hypothesizing. It wasn't a letter from me.
Okay, couple thoughts on the two different requests. Number two about why automatic train control is not coming back. I actually think that we probably aren't going to get anywhere with being like, we want your internal discussion emails about why you didn't do it. But I think if we really care about pushing on that, we could potentially have the opportunity to get the right member of the staff in the room with us and talk to them. So like with 7,000 series train cars, I thought that their seat arrangement was not the right seat arrangement. And we approached that not by asking for all the emails about their seat arrangement strategy, but by saying we want to sit down with the guy who's in charge of that decision about where to put the seats. And we talked about it back and forth, and you know, and we ended up coming to an understanding of why they made the decision they made, which I still didn't really agree with, but you know, now they understood what some riders thought. And we understood why they were doing what they were doing, because they were actually kind of forthcoming about that. So with that, I would suggest if we want to pursue that, we should try to figure out the right person to get in the room and sit down with that person and say, can you explain to us about this, you know, stuff? Like, we read what's been talking with what's been said so far, and we're kind of skeptical about this, this, and this, or, you know, we don't know if we agree on this point, and then have all the discussion. The first point, I do agree with Chelsea and Steven and so on, that this is something that they should be providing. And I would actually be very inclined to try to push staff and the board on the issue of whether things like data underlying on-time performance is something that the staff should just keep under wraps, which is what they want to do. I do think that if we make the request as we are making it, as you're phrasing it, the board will just say no. And so we just need to figure out a strategic way to get them to say yes. And I think that probably involves like trying to work with the performance office a little bit, even if we think we know what's going to happen, so that we can like build up our case and our explanation of why. So given it's only after 8:30, also I suggest that we take a vote. And if we don't go ahead with this letter, let's talk very quickly about what hours people want to go into a committee meeting about, which is what I was suggesting in that case.
Okay, well, it's both the question. So we have to take a vote to end debate. All in favor of ending debate and taking a vote?
Sorry about that.
Raise your hands if you're, if you want to end debate.
Is anyone not in favor of ending debate?
Yeah.
Is anyone opposed to ending debate? No.
Okay. All right. So then we'll take a vote. All in favor of Chris's motion, raise your hand.
So we got two.
Well, it's four or against.
Right now we're four against. Mm-hmm.
The motion was to appeal our denial or the denial of information to the full metro board. What we have now is a representing the views of the chair, the board, and the general manager. So the motion is to appeal that to the full metro board.
All in favor?
Okay.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Patrick, she abstains? The motion does not pass. Kelsey and then David.
Okay, so I'm sorry about that but I've heard some other opinions and so or some other perspectives. And so I don't know how to exactly word this, but I guess I want the motion that we as a rack meet with the vital signs group and that is known that we will come up with an inquiry from the rack, approved by the rack, to the board to get the type of data that we need for that the other form. I don't know.
Okay.
That's something like that.
Seconded by David. Any discussion on that?
I think we'll have enough people, but maybe can we get a quick show of hands of like who would come to that discussion and then so that seems to be enough people. So great, then that's it. I just want to make sure that like, you know, I love saying is like you don't want to then say, okay, come to the meeting and then there's only two people, you know, so like, we just need to make sure that we're actually doing it. And then I'll talk to
Carol.
This is not one motion. Is that
the special motion? Is there any other debate on this motion? All in favor? Any opposed? Any abstentions? Carol and Chris abstain. Okay. Carol?
I would just like to ask that on the next agenda we revisit the process because I'm still back at starting eight about the process.
Okay.
Just to make sure we're conforming to our bylaws about community meetings, is Kelsey the convener of the meeting? Yes. Is that she?
Okay, good.
Sure.
All right, okay. Thank you. Before we close tonight, I just wanted to.
Can we discuss this offline? The poor interpreter has been working for 2 hours without a break, and we either need to end soon or take a break.
Okay, the last thing that I want to say is just an announcement that as our bylaws state, in January we will be having elections for offices, and as you may or may not know, the offices are for 1 year terms, so all offices will be open, and so if you are interested or thinking about running, I encourage all of you to do so. Feel free to ask any of the current or former officers about their experience. And just a little bit about the process is that usually what happens is around December, sometime in December, people can email statements of intent to run over email. I suggest that you wait until after the new RAC appointments are made. This way, we'll know the email addresses of the people who will be here in January and who will be voting so that they get your statement could do it now if you want. So I just wanted to alert you to that, and maybe I'll do that a little more formally at the December meeting. Okay, meeting is adjourned.